Welcome to Pod 256, a weekly Bitcoin show focused on mining, energy, and proof of work. I'm your host, Rod, and I go by the handle BitKite on Twitter. Joining me this week are two amazing guests, the co-founders of Standard Bitcoin, Tom Massiero and Marty Bent. And episode two sure is to get spicy. So here's what we plan to cover. Miner capitulation, who's next? We're going to dig into Compute North and the story there. ERCOT. Just recently, there was an article in Wired about a little bit of a row between Bitcoin and their battery plans. Number three, is the hype over nuclear real or a LARP? We're going to discuss. Number four, the difficulty adjustment trends. Curious to know these guys' thoughts on which way we go. And then five, just because I got these guys in town, is ESG finally dead? So, welcome, gentlemen. Welcome to Nashville.
Good to be here.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, man. I guess before we get into it, maybe Tom and then Marty, if you guys want to share the quick story behind Standard Bitcoin and why y'all decided to mine in the great state of Tennessee.
Sure. So I would say the quick story is really it was when we were both leaving Great American Mining or in the process of leaving Great American Mining. I was relocating to this area, and it was one of those things that was a little bittersweet to leave a mining company that I had started. And one of the things that I wasn't able to accomplish, and neither of us were able to accomplish while we were there, was like actually mine ourselves. So this was kind of like a pact that we made with each other, which was like, dude, we're going to mine ourselves. And we bought some machines, we bought a hash hut, and it started off as not a business at all. It was just kind of like us scratching our own personal itch. And so there was nothing really elaborate about it. I moved here, there's natural gas around me, and we were able to buy a hash hut from our good friend Steve up at Upstream Data. Bought some beautiful Wutz miners at the top of the bull market, which we'll never, ever to be able to pay off. And the rest is history. So
I think they'll pay themselves off at some point. There's been many years.
Yes, hyper-Bitcoinization, that will happen.
Yes.
That's awesome. I joke with my friends. I say, I love Bitcoin and I'm addicted to hash. It's like once you get into the mining game and you get your fingernails dirty and you do the actual work, all you want to do is, you slowly adjust your DCA buys, or at least this is my experience, and then all of a sudden you're DCAing into quality MicroBT miners. And you're right, buying at the top and seeing that price per terahash and then slowly go down, it's like, oh, it can't go below $50, right, guys? It can't go below $40, guys, right, per terahash? Oh, where are we right now, Tom? Probably.
I think you're pretty close to $10 terahash if you know the right circles.
Damn.
Yeah. No, it's funny because this time last year, it was around we bought our miners, October, November last year. It was like right around the all-time high. People were screaming $200 terahash coming next year. And the complete opposite direction.
Yeah. And we were all excited because, we have the hookups. We can get the best pricing. Yeah. So we got, $10 below what everyone else was paying, and we thought we had made it.
Oh, and by the way, you're buying futures contracts, and you're not getting a delivery for another, let's say, 6 months on those really nice new 100 terahash machines.
Well, that's one thing we learned at Great American Mining and tried to apply to what we're doing with Standard Bitcoin is never buy futures, just buy spot.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's all these trends that happen in mining, and it's really easy to get sucked up into these. And it's probably the same thing with the greater Bitcoin ecosystem as trends happen. And it's, I've seen it, I've fallen into it. But I think, that's the one main lesson I've learned is never buy a mining machine unless you can plug it in that day or as soon as you get it. And, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose on the spot stuff. But if you're doing futures, you're just gambling with it.
Clip that out, Tom, because that is such sage advice. You need to have that hosting side ready to go and really understand your unit economics around that. And also have a low time preference, because similar to kind of buying Bitcoin, I'm not a trader and I'm not buying and selling Bitcoin. I'm buying and hopefully hodling for, future generations. The same strategy applies with Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that we did early on. Our third partner, Matt, when we got the machines in, there was going to be a gap before our upstream data hash out arrived. And, you know, I'm just, these things are sitting in my garage. I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars of machines sitting there. And I'm like, this, like, we have to plug these in. We have to. And, you know, my partner had a, you know, kind of like a leftover storage kind of facility that had electricity. And he was like, well, I've got like 10 cent power amp at this place. Like, let's plug in a couple of machines. So we went over there, plugged them in. We did the whole, you know, pleb setup where we routed the exhaust out the window. And honestly, like that particular setup was like, man, once you plug things in for the first time, it's very addictive.
Yep.
Because you're thinking, okay, how can I get more? Where can I find more power to do this? And you know, from there, you just scale from that point on.
One of the earlier terms that you coined, or at least I don't know if you coined it, but stuck with me, is that Bitcoin miners are just energy pirates. So you're just going around. Was it Marty?
It was John Seth. Yeah. It was not me.
Yeah, it was on his podcast.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool. And yeah, there are energy pirates. And like literally it's like you got consistent, reliable energy that's cheap and we can have a fixed quality contract and good relationship. Let's rock and roll. So let's talk about the folks, number one, which is maybe there's a lot of hype, especially from last year, and a lot of companies coming into the space, Compute North specifically. So actually this article in Bloomberg, which was published yesterday, they're basically having a fire sale on their assets. On the first episode with Colin last week, we touched on some of the assets that were being sold by Compute North. I think Foundry took over some of the sites. US Bitcoin took over the Kearney location. And then in this article, Marathon was potentially bidding on some of the sites. And then I think they're just like, as of today, they decided they're not going to bid on it. I don't know if Tom, you have any insight?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to watch Marathon operate, because it's kind of like those memes where it's like the bell curve of like, is this guy you know, an idiot, or is he like a, you know, a genius? See,
a caveman or 140 IQ.
And like, that's how I always think about Marathon. I'm like, are they really that dumb? Or is it like they're like on, you know, galaxy brain level? And, you know, this is a perfect situation where it's like, you know, they preach this asset light kind of model and they really have gotten burned by it, because they've put a lot of money and a lot of their resources into folks who are failing from a hosting provider perspective. And yet they're supposed to be the biggest Bitcoin miner there is. And now they have an opportunity to now buy some of this infrastructure at probably a very reduced rate. So they never have to worry about them getting their, you know, their cords unplugged. And for some reason, they've decided to not do that. It's very interesting, because this US Bitcoin company, has, if you follow the breadcrumb trails, there's a guy named Mike Ho who is involved with this. And he used to be involved with Marathon, got into some litigation with Marathon. And essentially, he's part of US Bitcoin. He went to US Bitcoin and they bought these sites that Marathon hosts at now, that Marathon machines are hosted at now.
Interesting.
So in Fred's commentary today, he was like, oh, we were only involved in the bidding just to make sure a competitor didn't buy the site. But in reality, you actually have someone who's like former litigation against your company who bought the site.
Wow.
So I don't think that that's necessarily like a positive outlook or a positive outcome potentially on some of these sites. So we shall see.
I think especially a lot of these miners that as publicly traded mining companies or in general, that's why, I mean, I have a little bit of hosting relationship with folks that I, you know and trust. But if you don't own or really have a good deal on the land, the infrastructure, all the way full stack, you're leaving yourself open to a lot of potential disaster. You mentioned unplugging or removing the cord. Like, you don't want somebody to have that much power over you, in my humble opinion.
No, I mean, vertical integration is the end game here. Just from a pure economic standpoint, it's, if you just look at the trends and where this is going, those that are going to be most successful are those who vertically integrate as much as possible.
Totally. And if I could, one other point is, I think also not getting above your skis, like when we're talking about even one megawatt or 5 megawatt to 10 megawatt, anything above those levels, I'm like, there's, you add in so much more additional risk. Like you don't get a transformer or a substation. You don't get the power turned on by the point in time you needed to get turned on. There's probably, Tom, I don't know, from your experience, like a number of other risks associated to that.
Oh my goodness. It's I mean, just from the practical standpoint of building a site, I mean, this was something that we dealt with when we built our first on-grid site here in Tennessee was, okay, what's the process look like from once this thing is built and the inspection on who approves it? Because, you know, you hear these horror stories of like, you know, some electrical inspector with a hair up his butt and he's like, you know, hey, you're going to change this, this, and this. And then all of a sudden your OPEX or your CAPEX bill has ballooned 10X.
And you have by to the way, months. You on your hosting side, you have a fixed rate to your either your investors or your retail partners and so on. So you're not adjusting that price up. So you're kind of eating that cost.
Yeah. And every day that site's not live, you're essentially burning money. So, you know, there's things at like that granular level. And then there's things up further up the scale, like where I've recently talked with Max Gagliardi about these, I call them like zombie mining farms, like you see in China, the zombie cities. Well, there's zombie mining farms down in Texas because of all the hopium that was pushed during like this Texas mining, whatever you want to call it, stampede. We're all going there, you know, ERCOT can handle all this. And a bunch of people built, I mean, a bunch, like dozens and dozens of projects got built. And then, and when I say built, I mean everything, containers, transformers, everything connected, new substations. And then all they need is ERCOT to flip the switch and they wouldn't.
Yeah.
Like imagine getting that far.
Yep.
And not realizing all the way up until then that you don't control them being able to give you power. It's mind blowing.
Yeah. ERCOT's slow rolling everybody. And it's the whole Texas mining meme. Somebody lives in Texas and somebody who loves the mining industry and loves individuals within the Texas mining industry was a bit of a LARP, I think, at the end of the day.
You know, Slim, who's here in Nashville, and we're hosting the Tennessee Beef Initiative Micro Summit tonight, has the great meme of, you know, shake your rancher's hand. Mm-hmm. Well, slowly but surely, you need to shake your energy producer's hand and like really know your local relationship with the person that's providing that energy, that consistent, reliable source of energy when they say they're going to do that. Because you guys both nailed it. Even that one day delay or that 1 week delay or 1 month delay potentially sours relationships. But more importantly, you're running a tight ship in terms of capital. Right. And like all of a sudden when you're dry, you don't have any of that dry gunpowder ready to go. Oh, and by the way, the price of Bitcoin goes from 40K down to freaking 16K. No bueno.
Yeah. That's, I mean, when you compare what's going on in Texas with these mega farms, 100, 200 megawatts, a gigawatt even with Riot's new facility, that time cost of capital from like breaking ground the first day to building that out over 18 to 24 months, there's so much uncertainty, so much capital. And like Tom said, there's a bunch of zombie farms that spend tens of millions of dollars to build all this infrastructure only to see ERCOT say, no, can't turn the power on. And even if they did turn the power on, there's a high likelihood that they would be barely profitable and probably unprofitable.
Mm. Right, because there was this other thing that was going on is during the hopium stage of the Texas stampede was, oh, you're able to achieve like sub 2 cent pricing, which is like this holy grail of all Bitcoin mining. Everyone you talk to, I get sub 2 cent pricing. And this is for folks who have been in it as long as we have. We've been in it since around 2017, 2018. And we would always hear these numbers and they were never real. We would always like talk to each other.
No, you always have to go, really, what's your all-in cost? Right. It'll be like 2 cents.
You're like,
no.
Wink, wink. Like you can tell us, like, you know. And that's the case was like some of these guys would build with this assumption that, oh, we're going to achieve this negative 2 cent pricing or sub 2 cent pricing. But in reality, it's 2 cent pricing. Then there's all of these other tariffs and
transmission cost.
And I've got to pay $100 million bond on this PPA that I've got to, you know, include. And then it doesn't exist. So then they plug in and they're at like 5 and 6 cents.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you could have done that it like in 49 other states and been up and running like 8 months ago.
Yep. So let's jump in. Let's dig deeper into Texas. We got a Texan here, you know, with Marty. It is interesting. And this is another article on Wired that actually was published. When was this published? Actually yesterday as well. So it was a row erupts over Texas's bold Bitcoin battery plan. So, and Tom, again, I don't know if you coined this term, but it's stuck with me because you talk about this, which is Bitcoin miners help with grid stabilization. And so Bitcoin miners are coming to Texas to say, hey, we can help, you know, stabilize the grid as well as prevent, potentially future blackouts. But the quote-unquote experts are saying it may exacerbate the problem. So I don't know who wants to take this one first.
We were talking about this in the car ride. Tom picked me up. Was kind enough to pick me up from the airport this morning. And this is what we talked about. And this Tom is, and I— Tom
by the way, Southern hospitality.
Yes. You know, here. I picked you up when you came to Austin.
That's right.
Tom and I have been on this tip for a while, which is like there's this big meme in Bitcoin mining specifically that Bitcoin mining incentivizes the build out of renewable energy, particularly wind and solar, because it somehow stabilizes these energy resources, which doesn't make any sense. And this is the meme that the Texas mining industry, particularly in West Texas with their wind farms and solar farms, has been running with, is like we can build out more wind and solar capacity, and Bitcoin mining allows us to do that. And it's never, ever made sense to me, because no matter how much capacity you build out of wind and solar, the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. You can have hundreds of gigawatts of capacity for these resources, but if the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, there's nothing Bitcoin mining can do to help it. So we would actually argue, I'll speak for myself, I would argue, I think Tom agrees, that Bitcoin mining could actually be a net negative for the Texas grid because they're running with this narrative and it's incentivizing more build out of these unreliable resources.
Yeah, it's a net negative for the consumers of Texas electricity. It's great for energy developers because these energy developers are getting renewable energy credits from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And essentially, with Bitcoin miners coming in and saying, hey, we'll consume that, it kind of allows them to have kind of an unfair advantage already on top of the subsidized kind of component of their business to continue to build more. And so what struggles are, so what they're competing against is more coal, more natural gas, or more, I would say, consistent baseload sources. And then who does that affect most? It affects the rate payers of Texas, which have seen their rates almost double or triple in the last couple of years. Back in the day, not even like 5 years ago, Texas electricity rates were some of the lowest in the country. Mm-hmm. And so what's changed? I thought Bitcoin miners were stabilizing and it would make things so much better. But in reality, it hasn't had any impact for a consumer. For other parts of the industry, it's really great. So that's my take. And one caveat, though, is when people hear Texas miners, and Marty made the point, West Texas, because that's where a lot of this sun and wind is at. Riot is not in West Texas. Riot's taken like a different approach versus all their other, competitors down in Texas. They're close to Austin, more in East Texas, and they're provided power by a very different load system than like the sun and wind stuff that is out in West Texas.
And so, it seems
different play.
Yeah, and it seems like they're doing much better than their other folks. Yeah. And I'm curious to know your guys'
I think you can make the argument Riot does actually help make sure that electricity is provided to the grid when desperately needed at times of peak demand. Whereas,
yeah, right, because they're closer to coal facilities in that area. I mean, it's not something they talk about too much, but that's in order to get that amount of power consistently, you have to be near some type of stable
and reliable.
Yeah. And so when it comes to like grid stability, there's just nuance around it.
Yeah.
And we've experienced, like, we would make the argument that we're helping make some of these utility co-ops here throughout the TVA more stable by taking on some of their congestion problems.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's nuance even within certain jurisdictions, right? Like, so I told the story to Max last week. You know, I got called into the general manager's office at the electricity co-op that we're doing business with, and we're having kind of a sit down, and, you know, I just wrote a big check to them. So of course, you know, they feel special. I don't feel as special at that point, but, and she was like, well, what's your plans for future growth? And I'm like, oh, we're thinking about here. We have a LOI with this town. And she said, oh, I wouldn't do that if I were you. And I said, oh, well, why not?
Thanks for letting me know now.
Exactly. And I was like, I'm interested. Why not? She's like, well, you know, we're different. And other places like us are different than that particular place. And I said, well, help me understand. And she said, well, if you look at that area, it's growing exponentially. It's right outside of Knoxville. Tons of people are moving there. Businesses are coming there. Lots of commercial. She said, if you're going to take down 50 megawatts in that area, eventually you're going to be competing with households. Like, and it's going to be an issue here and in countless other rural areas. We're declining in our growth and even in our consumption. So like when we give you 10 megawatts, we have plenty of that. Like you're never going to have to compete with our rate customers here. And in fact, we use that term grid stabilization. She used it with me. I didn't come up with that. She said, you help stabilize the grid here, not just in terms of service, but in terms of our rates, because you guys come in and act like an artificial growth for our area. And then that way we can, you know, we have a mandate by our co-op members to keep prices down. And so it works in harmony. Whereas just in this, I mean, literally two counties over, it would not be as advantageous. And then that's when you're in the, you know, the Junseth quote, he's talking about becoming energy pirates. Have you got a chance to listen to old Junseth at all?
Okay.
Not Bitcoin really. Uncensored is a great, great podcast to go back and listen to. But they would read stories of like these miners getting kicked out of states like in Washington State or upstate New York. And he basically was like, well, Bitcoin miners are energy pirates. They're going to keep taking and taking and taking till they can't take anymore. And, you know, when you're competing against, you know, people's homes and their ability to like either heat or cool themselves, that's not going to end well. And so, you know, don't put yourself in that position.
Totally. A quick tangent. You mentioned Washington. So I'm now very fortunate to get a lot of, especially in this down bear market, a lot of deal flow in terms of, hey, we got this operation. You want to, you know, invest in it or send some of your miners over and blah, blah, blah. Anytime I hear the states like Washington, Illinois, New York, it's like you could say like change those states and insert like Russia, Kazakhstan and whatever, because it's like a hard no for me. But if I hear Texas or Tennessee or Nebraska or you know, some of these type of states, Oklahoma to a degree, it's like, okay, that'll be interesting. And then the second point, you know, I mentioned, you know, I love Bitcoin and being addicted to hash, starting with an S9 and moving my Y up, even having a hosted relationship. Now I'm to the point where if I can't go touch and feel like those miners and know the person on the other end that I'm doing the deal with, it's almost a hard no. Which is a good segue because you mentioned the letters TVA. And I wanted to touch on this, which is around nuclear. Is it real or is it a LARP from your guys' perspective?
Well, let's just clarify that concept. Not nuclear in general as a LARP, but I specifically mean, is the nuclear hype within Bitcoin mining a LARP?
And maybe are we just too early for that right now? Maybe is the conversation talking about the potential of it so much that is it like now, or is it maybe like 5 or 10 years from now that it could become? And the SMRs, I think they're called small modular reactors that come into play.
That's the sexy thing right now.
Yes. Yeah. When you say SMR, you smiled. So that was nice.
Tom and I go back and forth on this.
What's your take, Marty?
SMRs have not gotten through the regulatory red tape and have not actually gotten to market in any materials at any material scale. Just intuitively, they make sense to me if they work. I just like plainly think we should stop building wind and solar and just focus on nuclear. And in regards to Bitcoin mining, I don't know if it's like the end all be all, the next big thing of cheap electricity. Certainly stable. I mean, like you mentioned, TVA, what's it, 45%?
Yep.
Of the base load here is nuclear. Provides us very stable base load, which we love as miners. I would take a step back more broadly and just like, I think we need more nuclear power, which is as society, not as Bitcoin miners. Maybe it does help Bitcoin miners in certain situations. It certainly helps us here. But yeah, with a mix. The SMRs too, like if they work, I think they will be cool. And Bitcoin mining could play a small part of that.
Yeah. So yeah, that's my big thing is that people are putting all their eggs in this SMR basket, and it's just not. It's kind of, I mean, it, you know, people. You know, we were having a conversation on chain versus Lightning earlier. SMRs are kind of the same way with it. I'm not going to provide any color into which camp you would fall in, but SMRs are similar in the aspect of like people are just automatically assuming that this is. You know, this is the way, this is the future. When you actually start peeling back the layer, and I'm not one of these big brain analyst types, okay? So when I think about mining, I'm always like, what's the only incentive that matters? Is it cheap enough to do it? And unfortunately, what's been promoted out there is nuclear is a cheap energy source. It's actually not cheap to build these things. Like the CapEx needed to build a new, and even an SMR is insanely expensive. And they achieve payback over like 30, 40 years. So they can amortize these things out. So, okay, you're going to put all your hope into having mining in like a 5 or 6 cent all-in rate. Like that's their cost. But then what happens in the renewable energy space is kind of like this circular cycle thing that's happened. So like 10 or 15 years ago, natural gas did this end around where they essentially branded coal and nuclear as being bad. It was really pretty amazing marketing back then. So natural gas took a bunch of market share away from coal and then basically scared people from building new nuclear sites. That's how natural gas got its market share. And then what ended up happening with solar and wind is solar and wind said, well, natural gas is bad. So like you need to build more of these things, right? And so now it's slowly taking away like more natural gas load. What nuclear is doing is like they've learned. They're saying, okay, we got to get in on this virtue signaling thing too. And so nuclear has basically said, okay, we're going to get some of these renewable energy vibes and they're going to come and start taking away from natural gas and wind and solar's kind of market share. And so we're just going to see these cycles rinse and repeat because really all it's boiled down to is the subsidy game that plays during these cycles. So like all of these wind and solar subsidies are about to end. And so what's going to happen next? You're already seeing the signaling of this new age in nuclear. You're seeing like for people have moved from, we will not build any new nuclear sites to we need to. And so what happens during that part? It's going to be labeled as such. And so then if you have subsidies that are part of this whole thing, I feel like that's when Bitcoin doesn't mix well as far as a partner goes. It seems like it would be a good partner, but I don't know. We'll see.
Just adds a bunch of hidden cost. And that's another, like, it's not always as that, like we're talking about, like what's your all-in cost? Yeah. It's like one thing, wind and solar. I don't know why they get away with this, but they use like the levelized cost of energy, which is just a complete.
Explain that. What does that mean?
It's the cost. The way I understand it, it's like the cost of the electricity as it's being produced. And since wind and solar is intermittent, they don't factor in the cost that it takes to produce electricity to make up for the wind and solar it's not being produced. Mm. And so like the actual, like if you're mining on a wind or solar farm that's backed up by a natural gas plant and you have to turn the natural gas plant on to produce electricity for customers when wind and solar isn't blowing, like that's not included in LCOE. So those end users are not paying what the LCOE is. Maybe they're paying that when wind and solar is actually producing electricity, but when it's not, natural gas gets kicked up, they're paying for that as well. And that's not factored into that LCOE cost. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah. I mean, I just, it's one of those things where if you hear it described, you're like, oh, that makes sense. Because, you know, you hear wind and solar being really, really cheap. Well, it is once it's going. But then what's the cost of it when it's not producing? That like that's all part of like this mm-hmm. whole system. So if it's making power at 2 cents or 1 cent per kilowatt hour during the day, but then as soon as the sun goes down, it's not making any power. You have to average in what that actually looks like for the amount of output that you have. And there's a guy on Twitter named, I think it's Brian Gitt. Is that his name?
Yes.
You should follow him. He provides an amazing, like these little digestible facts, because this guy was a renewable energy advocate and I don't even want to even call him like an evangelist per se. He was in California. He was in the industry. He worked in the sun and or solar and wind side of things. And he basically became disenchanted because he realized he was selling people snake oil, you know, with these rooftop solar deals, and realizing they would never pay off, that you don't get the output that you think that you're getting, and all this other stuff. So.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word subsidies. You know, it's like, not to pull a Charlie Munger quote or bring him into the fold, but, you know, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. And it's like, when you provide all of these subsidies, you're going to see a rush of, you know, these terribly looking solar panels on roofs, or you're going to see the... By the way, have you ever driven by a wind farm?
They're terrible.
They're terrible. I mean, you want to talk about a Bitcoin mining farm being noise or bad for the community? Put some of those wind farms in your community, in your backyard.
Drives people crazy.
So I think people need to take a step back and just, you know, think intelligently and make some proper decisions.
Yeah, well, and again, this was something that we've been trying to do, maybe me more aggressively, but it's, like you said, like that cycle of wind and solar attacking nuclear, natural gas attacking nuclear and coal, like now nuclear is going to be able to attack all of them. Like, we just need to get past that point where it's, this is the best energy, we have to use this. It's, we need to get to a point in society where, number one, we realize energy is good. We need more energy. We're going to need a lot more. We need to figure out how to do it in the most efficient and environmentally friendly way possible, in terms of like not polluting, but we also have to recognize that we're going to need coal, we're going to need that gas, we're going to need oil, we're going to need nuclear, and I'll even admit we'll need solar or wind in some capacity, but it's as an add-on in very specific situations.
Look, yeah,
competition's a good thing, and let the free market compete for the best energy sources. And you nailed it. The more energy leads to greater prosperity, greater livelihoods, longer livelihoods, healthier livelihoods, and so on. So we need to do more. And I think this is a term we used back in the tech or creative days. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You actually like shouldn't just say, okay, let's just turn off all of these fossil fuel plants and so on, and then just trust these some unproven energy, consistent and reliable energy sources, right, and go full ham over here. I don't know if you wanted to jump on.
Well, I was going to say, like, one theme, or maybe, I don't know, trend that we could see happen is, I think there will be a continued push for more localization. You know, that's the response to globalism, is like make things more balkanized. And so like in that push for more of like a localization play, I think that's what you'll start seeing is small municipalities who have their own source of energy, meaning hydro. If they live in the Southwest, that could be solar. If it's in areas in Appalachia, there's a lot of natural gas. And in those situations, I can see Bitcoin mining having a copacetic relationship with the energy production that happens. And it's much more in line with the natural incentives of Bitcoin mining.
Amen. Now let's talk about something like somewhat spicy and something that we kind of pray to the mining gods about, which is the difficulty adjustment. Not to go hard right into the difficulty adjustment, but it's difficulty adjustment, by the way, like our, even though it's free market, is like the way we look at the interest rates and like, you know, Jerry Powell and be like, hey, Jerry, are you going up or down? You know, and then everyone makes business decisions based on, I mean, I will say with mining, you cannot, Drew Armstrong from Cathedra had a good tweet thread, which is, you know, it's like a gigantic mega yacht. You know, you can't just like course correct quickly when you've had this infrastructure on and you've prepaid your hosting for like a month or 2 months in advance. So like, even though you may be underwater, you've already paid it. So you're going to continue to host and you may turn off in 2 months ahead of time. So like, are we seeing, not to lead you guys, but I'm curious to know, and I'll ask more generally, difficulty adjustment trends, where do you see us going from here?
Well, I'd like Marty to riff on that that concept that you just brought up. I saw him perk up when you mentioned like...
I've never thought of it that way.
Because I feel like anytime Jerry gets up there he's like, hey, interest rates are going up. Ooh, sell off in the market. And we see everything kind of dipping.
Well, the beauty of like the difficulty adjustment is you don't have to like try to assume what
Jerome's going to say when he finally gets in front of the podium to explain the Federal Open Market Committee notes. You can sort of see it and begin preparing for it, but it's like a natural, it's like baked in.
And insiders have access, you know.
But I would say
everybody has access, even people who aren't mining. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm saying on Jerome Powell's side. Yeah.
And I've seen in the past, especially when there are positive difficulty adjustments that are taking place, miners will play games with hash rate, especially right towards the end or beginning of those cycles to either push things over. And then you'll see like crash either jump or the price will either jump or crash based off of how much hash rate will kind of come online or come offline. I've noticed those games that get played quite frequently, but it doesn't happen as much on the negative difficulty side.
Yeah. It's shout out for the negative difficulty adjustment this week. But no, like you said, Rod, it's a really good point you bring out, like what to expect going forward. And I do think that I think there's many scenarios. Tom is bearish on difficulty in the short to medium term.
Yep. And looks like I'm wrong for the next epoch.
And when you say bear, meaning like he thinks the total hash rate is going to go up. Off. Oh, it's going to come off.
Come off. Yes. Okay. And what you just mentioned, like a lot of these on grid miners will prepay X amount of months. Sometimes the more you pay, the cheaper all-in rate you get. So some will pay 6 to 8 months, maybe a year even up front. And I could see there certainly being a scenario in which there's a number of miners who have done these prepayment deals and are inching towards insolvency and are just white-knuckling it until they chew through their prepayments and then turn off once they're done.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I thought with this last negative difficulty adjustment, you know, I was kind of, because I was kind of jumping on that bandwagon before it became cool. I thought, you know, I was like, I'm going to really go out on a ledge. I'm going to say it's going to happen twice in a row. But right now, it's looking like it's going to be positive by a couple percent. And I think what's unique is that there's a lagging indicator when hash rate either comes online or comes offline. There's people always building and people taking stuff off. So it's hard to get the timing right. But then there's another thing that's happening too, is you have these like savvy, or I won't even call them savvy, people who have been in mining for a while. I heard Ben Gagnon from Bitfarms really talk about this on a podcast he did probably a couple weeks ago, where he was like, hey, you know, because we own our own infrastructure, our own farms, we have the ability to go and underclock these machines. Now, people who are hosting typically don't have that luxury to be able to do that, because for the mining farm owner, we're incentivized to sell the most electricity for the highest rate we possibly can. We don't want it doesn't help us if a miner says, oh, actually, I want to cut my power use in half. And then, you know, I don't get paid as much and I don't make as much margin. So anyways, I think that's what's happening too right now, is that you've got some folks who are getting really, you know, people are really, they love to talk in the bull markets about overclocking. How much can you get out of a machine? But underclocking will actually allow you to live in a bear market. And so you've got folks who are taking like an S19J and turning it into, it's like a superpower. You can either bulk up or slim down, right? And so with an S19J, with a either Brains firmware or another aftermarket firmware, they can go from 30 watts per terahash-ish down to 23, which is equivalent to an XP.
Wow.
In terms of efficiency, yeah. Yeah, I saw somebody was touting that. I think it was like 34 watts of terahash down to like 23 and a half. They're only producing like 65 terahash a second. But it's way more profitable.
Yeah. I mean, you go from making or not making any money at all to making like in multitudes more. Now, it's not like you're printing money, but like you're profitable and you're staying alive, which is the only thing that matters when you're mining in a bear market. It's not to make money. It's to stay alive.
Yeah. Be a cockroach. And I think about the underclocking versus overclocking. And then what comes to mind is how flexible you have to be, or nimble you have to be as a miner, to think of every single opportunity just to stay freaking alive.
Yeah, that goes to Marty's point about being vertically integrated. When you're vertically integrated, you can make that choice. No problem. Like, for example, we have an on and an off-grid portion of our business. The off-grid side of things, where we have fixed costs, it's nice and cool out right now.
Yeah.
All of our guys are trying to mine as much as they can. There's no underclocking available. In fact, a lot of them are overclocking. So that's a scenario because we own that resource. We're not subject to some of this other pressure, and you know, we can get more hash rate right now.
Isn't it kind of crazy just like following weather patterns now? And it's like, oh, dang.
Well, I mean, we ran into that at Great American Mining, like particularly trying to deploy.
Yeah.
We learned a hard lesson the first year we started deploying in the Bakken. We're like, oh, it gets pretty terrible out here. It's not as easy to set up generators and plug in a mining data center on a flare gas site in the middle of January in North Dakota.
Yeah, brutal. I mean, brutal. They was just, I wouldn't recommend that. And then you think you'd learn from it, right? But just the way the cycles work, it was like, oh, we did the same thing the next year. Just because that's just how things work. And, you know, there's just that incentive. Like, do you wait 2 months to plug it in? Well, when you have the ability, like that was one of the superpowers about off-grid at that time. Right now, it's not the same because with the rise in oil and gas prices, the activity in the oil field has gone up. So before you could get a very favorable rate on generator rentals. Now you can't get that. And so you might as well just set up on-grid if you're gonna do that, because on-grid pricing and the new generator rental pricing is essentially the same now. And it's much easier to mine on-grid. I mean, it's just more stable, it's easier. But for off-grid, if you're like, wait a minute, I can just put a generator on a site as fast as I possibly can. I can get mining tomorrow if I want to. Like, that's a superpower.
Yeah, again, going back to vertical integration, I think it's a lesson we learned off-grid too, was if you're going to do it, buy your generators.
Yeah.
And that's what's great about the hashouts. The hashouts come with the generators. Steve makes them purposely for off-grid mining.
And by the way, not to plug Bitcoin Park, but Steve, Adam, Rob over at Upstream are shipping a 50-kilowatt hash generator, and we're going to put that in the parking lot, and we're going to have that thing running at the next Bitcoin mining meetup in January. So January 11th, if you can make it out to Nashville, come and see it for, you know, touch and feel it yourself.
Yeah, that's our go-to size.
Is it 50 kilowatt?
50 kilowatt.
All right. I think they I think Adam actually already sold it potentially. But I think if they haven't sold it, they're going to be selling it to a Tennessee miner. So if you're out there and want to buy it.
I might know somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, that particular unit too, you know, there's all these, what Steve's done is like, and what Upstream's done is very, very innovative, because, and they haven't really even touched the surface yet of a lot of the use cases. For example, the orphaned and distressed wells that are all throughout Appalachia. I mean, there's literally probably close to a million of them. The size generators that he sells, which nobody else sells, it's not a use case for any other type of oil and gas application. I could see him eventually getting like some type of contract from like a major government agency to say, hey, this is actually how we want to deal with some of these leak methane or methane leaks that are, you know, throughout these assets, and they're literally perfect for it. So we just got to keep, what I've noticed in Bitcoin mining specifically is it's kind of like dog years. Things happen really, really fast. Like you're like, oh, I've been in mining since 2018, and it feels like you've been in mining for, and there are guys who have been in mining way longer than us, but going through like a bear cycle is incredible. And like it just provides you so much to be able to deal with the emotional kind of baggage with it. I just see people are like, they literally look like they're dead, you know, like they're staring into the abyss, like they don't know what to do. And I'm just like, oh, we've already lived through this. Now, it doesn't mean it was easy, because I literally was doing the same stare. I mean, we didn't know if we were going to make it with Great American Mining. And, you know, if you can just stay alive, we had one unit going. Everyone thought Great American Mining was this huge operation because, you know, we didn't market it. It was just like there weren't a lot of miners. And being a miner in the United States at that time, there was not many of us.
Because
like
cool.
So much of the hash rate was over in China. They were just like these 2-bit players and whatever. And then it became cool. I honestly think you helped make it cool.
That's true. Yeah.
hey, like, branding was cool.
You ran, like, I just did the podcast and talked about it. You ran all.
I know, but it was this idea behind Off Grid and stuff. And like, we started telling that story. Steve's got his company. Crusoe's doing their thing. Like, it was like, holy crap, like, miners are doing like hard things. It wasn't just the, because prior to that, it was all you saw were stories of, and I'm not trying to disparage bit farms here, but and that's not what I'm doing at all. But you would only see stories of these big, gigantic warehouses where, you know, it's like walls of miners and people would plug them in. And it's kind of like this cold, the aesthetic isn't really like pleasing. It's kind of like, ooh, it looks like a dungeon or, you know, some type of penitentiary or something like that for machines. And then you see these pictures of these guys out in the oil field and doing these really difficult engineering-based, you know, kind of like applications. And like, it was cool.
Yeah.
And you, I'm just saying, like, you helped amplify it because you saw it early on and you started talking about it. And then other people started noticing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The aesthetics are much better off grid. Like, you were doing a deployment. You posted a picture of it on Twitter, didn't you? Like, we're like on top of a mountain.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're running up against time, and I do want to tee Marty up, especially with the last bullet, which it seems like the topic is ESG finally dead? but it looks like activist investor Bluebell is calling for the BlackRock CEO, Larry Fink, to step down based on a number of his decisions that he's made, one of which probably is around the ESG side. So
it's dying. It's not dead.
Dying, not dead.
I think Vanguard just came out and announced they're winding down some ESG funds as well. It deserves a die. And it's dying under its own weight because it's economically infeasible from first principles. You can LARP and talk about fields all you want, but at the end of the day, market forces come into play. And if you're not making money and you're not making people's lives better, the market will react.
Yep.
That was Marty nicely saying, sweep the leg. Someone needs to do that meme with like Marty, you know, wipe the blood off Johnny's lip, sweep the leg. You know, I think too that specifically Marty, because he was one.
Eat the hamburger.
So these were referencing the conversation that he had with Michael Saylor. Was that 2 years ago?
That'd be 2 years ago. Now.
Was that with Austin and Darren?
Yeah. For Feinstein from Core. Marty took a lot of heat because he took on, you know, literally the demigod of number go up technology and, you know, everything. And Saylor's done a lot of good things. But if you notice, and this is always, you know, I bring stuff up to Marty, you know, I'm like, yeah, I watch all the, you know, like the tells and stuff. And I'm like, almost every single Michael Saylor interview where he faces somebody where it's a little bit adversarial, he has these like gotcha quotes where he just absolutely like nukes somebody. And you see like these memes of him saying this and lasers are shooting out of his eyes and stuff. That was the one podcast that I think that Saylor ran scared because Marty had him on the defensive the whole time with ESG because he knew that he was kind of exposed to it in order to get that money into MicroStrategy. And yeah, you know, he made this comment like, just eat the hamburger, Marty. And Marty's like, I'm not eating the hamburger. You know, like, and now it's just like, you know, we can look back at it. And like at that time, you know, I remember Marty being like, dude, did I do the right thing? Was I too extreme? And I'm like, no, you were standing up for what's right. Like you're a truth teller. And
yeah, and I'll say this, and I think I mentioned this to Marty when he got here. It's like when history kind of, I hope, when it plays out, the principled approaches that you're taking that are consistent will echo across your legacy, right or wrong, but I believe right, in my humble opinion. By the way, I'm going to go, that reminds me, I'm going to go back and listen to that. Because that was such a good one. It was you, Austin, Darren, and Saylor on that. I remember that.
Well, it was actually 3-1 in retrospect. But let's see if you catch that when you watch.
We'll put a pin on that one, gentlemen. And by the way, Tom, what's the best place for folks to follow you?
Oh yeah. So usually I'm like, you know, the guy behind the thing. But we just launched our Twitter account, and it's the Standard BTC.
Okay, rock and roll. We'll put that in the show notes. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. Obviously, at Marty Bent. By the way, that domain, Standard Bitcoin, is freaking awesome. And that brand name is freaking awesome.
Tall Tom. At Great American Miner, can we tell a little backstory?
Sure.
We became very fascinated because we were working in the oil and gas industry. We became very fascinated with the titans of the oil and gas industry in the early days, the Rockefellers. And we also became enamored with James J. Hill, and who was a magnate during the railroad boom, especially up north. And that's what standard Bitcoin. I'll let you add color to this, but we see it as like Bitcoin being similar, like discovering like these oil and gas, and that you can turn them into like energy Bitcoin with the new monetary system and the different layers with the technology and the mining. We view it as big of an opportunity, and we wanted to sort of make an homage to that via standard Bitcoin, and use it as sort of like a lingering thought in the background. Like, we want to strive.
I love that.
To be this big.
Yeah, that was great. That was very well put. I'm not as eloquent as Marty. I think the one thing that when I try to describe, you know, everyone's like, you know, I get a lot of our mining friends are like, okay, so what are you doing that's different? You're just a hosting provider. And I'm like, well, I guess you could say that, but you know, the technical way that we would put it is like, we're this infrastructure company. But like how we see that in terms of like what you just described with the standard, you know, kind of the standard idea is we want to be able to stack Bitcoin without having to own an ASIC. And when we realized, when we started building a lot of these sites and doing on-grid and off-grid, was that's the real hard part. And I can become more like, I don't have to worry about competing against everybody and their mother buying an ASIC for the same price. Like, I can actually go figure out how to buy or acquire oil and gas assets that give me a competitive advantage, or building on-grid sites that can give us a competitive advantage. So then we can partake in some of the hash rate that's developed from that, and I don't have to put up the CapEx for it. And there's probably, and to me, that's operating on the Bitcoin standard, to kind of, you know, make a play on that side of things. So I'm very interested in like where that takes us. You know, there's going to be a lot of other applications or use cases that kind of apply to building infrastructure that allows Bitcoin mining, that we don't necessarily have to own any of the machines, but we can still partake in the upside of Bitcoin.
I freaking love it. And by the way, I love you guys' tagline on your Twitter. We have ways of mining Bitcoin that you know nothing of. That's like...
Yeah, that's a Rockefeller quote. That's what kind of, you know, taken out of context a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah, we want to set, like going back to like the vertical integration standpoint, like we want to set our customers up for success. Yep. And focus on what, I mean, I can't say I'm focusing on this. Tom and Matt, our other partner, are incredibly good at building out the infrastructure, and that's extremely valuable for people in the space.
Yeah, right now. And we're not experts. Like, we make a lot of mistakes. Like, you know, like Rod, you know, you and I knew each other prior, but you basically got to come on like the ride with me right from we were going to start doing this this 10 megawatt site that we did. And, you know, I was sending you these pictures and videos every day. I'm like, they're doing this stuff. I have no idea what they're doing right now. And you'd explain. And then that would make me want to make sure I knew what I was talking about. And, you know, you got to see the grind all the way through. And we made some mistakes, and we still make mistakes. I was just telling you earlier, I was up on top of this mountain, and I'm like, I'm getting this error code on these what's miners. I mean, it took me 45 minutes to go turn on four machines. And I get up there, and there's this error code, and I cannot figure it out. And then I just get a text this morning from Matt. He's like, hey, I went by the site today, turned it back on, and everything's good. I'm just like, all right, whatever. You know, that's just how it is. So I would just say that that's what's awesome about mining in general, is there's a lot of different talent stacks that get pulled into mining. Banking, oil and gas, energy, you know, electrical guys, people emit, like very, like there's a lot. I'm a generalist.
Yeah.
So I love it because I'm like, I just see building. I want to be an industrialist in this space. I know Marty likes that, like that term too. And I think we both kind of see ourselves in that same way. And then it's like, oh, how can I put an awesome team together
yeah.
that can go accomplish like really incredible goals? So that's what we're up to.
Well, for the folks still listening, go to bitcoinpark.co, join the meetup page in January. Both these gentlemen are going to be in attendance. And if you want to shake a rancher's hand, I would strongly recommend also shaking your miner's hand and shaking Marty and Tom's hand. Gentlemen, thank you so much. This was an awesome, awesome episode.
Thank you, Rod.
Thank you, Rod.